Hello, this is Chris English with At Home This Morning, our magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a window to the world, both in and around our city of Brighton and Hove and further afield, for both our older listeners and those not so old. In this packed edition of the programme, we'll be hearing from a quartet of sailing stars, a comedienne who'll be taking to a Brighton stage later this month as Shirley the Middle-Aged Siren. TV star Gloria Honeyford will be here with advice on gas safety in the home, and I'll be chatting to the gentleman who 60 years ago became the first person to join what was then the very fledgling Bluebell Railway. And finally, there'll be the latest news on the restoration of the Brighton Bell. So, without more ado, let's get going by hearing from Charles Hudson, who 60 years ago, this actual month, became the first person to join the Bluebell Railway. Except, at that stage, it was then known by a different name, as Charles explains.
At that time, it was the Lewes and East Grinstead Railway Preservation Society. That only held for about two meetings, and then it was the press had called it the Bluebell Line because of the profuse number of bluebells and primroses. It became the Bluebell Railway.
So how did that meeting come about? I mean, we've heard of the four students and Bernard Hopman. We know that story, but how did public word go out? I mean, days long before mobile phones and everything else.
Well, there had been a lot of press coverage of the line, as one will appreciate. This is pre-beaching. It was southern region of network of British Rail, as it was then, had decided to close the line as unremunerative. And they picked a date, but it was forestalled by an ASLEF strike in the May. So the line closed then, and then didn't reopen until the...
That was the Sulky service.
That was the Sulky service, that's right. The because of this press coverage, there'd been quite a lot of local press, and those of us who were keen on railways at the time were following this eagerly. And then it was announced that four students had come up with an idea of reopening the line privately. Anybody interested, would they come along to a meeting at Hayward's Heath on the 15th of March 1959, which was exactly a year since the line closed. Anyway, my friend and I duly came over, and
you joined up?
That's right, and I joined up. And but because we came over by public transport, we were a little bit late arriving in the meeting, so we slipped in at the back and sat in the two rear seats and listened to the meeting. At the end, the chairman had said that they needed to raise funds and they wanted subscriptions for the membership. Anybody wishing to join, please pay the treasurer on the way out. Well, the fact that we were sitting immediately in front of the treasurer, I turned around and put my £1, as it was, that was asked for on the table. And so I was the first one to subscribe by sheer accident. Anyway, I had receipt number one. And then they kept us in touch by... various literature came through the post, and eventually they got a lease on the station offices as a headquarters, and we were duly called to come along and give a hand cleaning up and getting the place ready.
I mean, what was the mood like in those days? And because, I mean, you've already said you were a young man, so was it just enthusiasm over expectation?
Yes, the younger people are all very enthusiastic because obviously the various pitfalls weren't quite realised by younger people like the older ones, and there was a lot of young people who were very enthusiastic, and we had a good enthusiastic membership at that time. We still have, of course, but there were quite a few older people in the audience who said, oh, hold on, what about so-and-so, what about this, what about that? But anyway, the pros won the day, and we duly set up. The meeting had been called by four students who had followed the proceedings in the press, and they wanted to call a meeting, but they needed a chairman. And this is when they called on Bernard Holden, who was the first chairman of the organisation, and he had been chairman of the Burgess Hill Model Railway Society, and he agreed to come along and chair the meeting, which he did. And of course he was associated with Bluebell right until the day he died at the age of 104, I would hasten to add. So he was a very respected gentleman.
Having got the lease on the station here at Sheffield Park, I mean, it was presumably vastly different to what it is today.
Oh, yes, yes, it was all very open. For example, being young, like, we looked around places where perhaps we shouldn't, and one of the places we went, as we climbed to the top of the water tower, there was an open ladder, completely unprotected, but we climbed to the top of that with our cameras and took photographs of the station area. And I've got a photograph at home somewhere where it shows the whole of the station yard without a vehicle in it, just three bare sidings covered in weeds, and the station platforms and track also weed covered, because it had been 12 months since the last train ran.
A huge amount of work to do. How did you end up being in charge of the signals?
Oh, well, when we realised we were going to be successful and get going, we realised, of course, that there needed to be a signalling system, and I was asked to, because I'd shown an interest in it, because of my background, they asked me to look into the signalling and see what could be done, because when the Sulky service had been arranged, British Rail clipped and padlocked all the facing points as a single line. So all these obviously had to be removed and connected to the signal frame. It wasn't a signal box as such, it was a frame on the platform with iron railings around it, only accessible from indoors. And this had to be connected up and got working. I was the one that organised all this and then formed what we call a signalling and telecommunications engineering department, which I still head to this day.
Very successfully. There's a signal box at Kingscote station on the line that I gather the box itself originated at Brighton.
That's correct. Brighton Upper Goods. It was one of the original boxes there that had been maintained when for controlling the sidings for Upper Goods when the Brighton Line first resignalling took place in the 1930s. It was made completely redundant, and we put in for purchasing it, and that was duly brought over here on a low loader. Quite a lot of famous photographs of it going through Cookfield as before the bypass was there, and then we had to build a new base. Initially it was going to come to Sheffield Park.
With the box itself at Kingscote, we're getting ahead of ourselves a bit. You've actually won an award.
Yes, we have. The signal box at Kingscote has a miniature lever frame in it, similar to what would have been at Brighton, that power frame. The reason it's a power frame is that we needed more space, and because it's part of our policy to try and preserve as much of the old infrastructure as possible over a period of time, the area of Kingscote up to East Grinstead is 1950s, and they were putting in, British Rail were installing these miniature lever frames in the 1950s, and so it seemed appropriate that we preserved one of these before they were lost forever.
Coming up to date, the 60th anniversary of the reopening of the railway, when did the railway actually open? When did you get to play trains?
The very first train ran on the 7th of August 1960, and that was two coaches and an engine at each end of those two coaches. The reason for the two engines, purely because we could only at that time run as far as Horsted Keynes exclusive, where we had erected a sleeper halt just outside by what is known today as the underbridge. And obviously the engine could not run round those two coaches, so they put an engine on either end of those two. The theory was that the London end engine worked going up and the south or country end engine worked coming back.
Presumably there'll be celebrations next year to commemorate that.
There will be, that's right, yes. I think there are plans to run a replica first train, because we've now got Horsted Keynes, which is a marvellous station for various high days and special events.
Looking back on your 60 years, what are your highlights and setbacks?
Oh, yes, there have been obviously setbacks over the years. I mean, a lot of necessary work, especially if the work is enhancing what is there today. You will always have the various people who want to leave things as they are and not progress, but do need to look to the future. Providing you're in the preserved world and it looks all right externally, if you can make things behind the scenes do that job more economically, then I think one should do it. For example, if you have a semaphore signal, it's nice to have it wire worked, but there are times when you have to make them power work. Now, the public don't see how it's worked, they just see the signal moving. It's only we engineers know the difference.
Where can you see the Bluebell in another 60 years?
Oh, I think the way we're going at the moment, I see it as a great future. Whether we should ever be running our own trains out onto the network, I don't know. But, of course, one has to bear in mind that you have to come up to a certain standard to run on the national network, otherwise you would create heavy penalties.
Further extensions to Haywards Heath and south of Lewes?
Yes, there have been various pipe dream thoughts of extending south. I don't think one will see it in my time, but there's currently thinking of extending westwards towards Haywards Heath. How far that will get remains to be seen. There is an active group of people who are keeping that on the table at the moment. Of course, there are no funds for doing just that, but because we own the land between Horsted Canes and Ardingly, for example, it's necessary to have a holding organisation to maintain that, to make sure that squatters or other people don't break down fences, for example. Because we own it, we have to maintain it, and this is currently being looked after. As and when the extension take place, I wouldn't like to hazard a guess.
But you're looking forward to the anniversary, the 60th anniversary of that formation, and you're number one?
Oh yes, indeed. I expect this won't be the first interview I shall be asked to do. Yes, it's quite an achievement. I mean, little did I realise in those far off days when I put my £1 on the table that I would be still in this position 60 years' time. It's amazing. Looking back, it's amazing what we've achieved. I mean, we've totally resignalled Sheffield Park twice over. We've refurbished Horsted Canes and then again resignalled it completely because all the old infrastructure was so tired and worn out it was past its sell-by date. So that's all been totally renewed. We've done the same for Kingscote. That's now a completely new installation. In other words, we have three working signal boxes on the line.
And it's all going to be maintained.
Oh, yes, indeed. And I have a very loyal chaps who support me very much, and I can't sing their praises enough. There are currently about 25 of them. They're not all here at any one time, naturally, but we get a nucleus of about 10 at a time.
Charles, more power to your elbow, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you.
That was Charles Hudson, who's member number one of what is now the Bluebell Railway Society. Now from railways to safety in the home. And joining us on the telephone are Gloria Honeyford from Rip Off Britain on BBC One Television and Scott Darrock from Gas Safe. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
And how, first of all, Gloria, ladies first, as always.
Thank you. You're very gentlemanly.
Welcome to the programme, Gloria.
Thank you very much.
Now, how important is it not to cut corners?
Well, there are some corners that we all cut, don't we, really? In life, I'm talking about, because we're all chasing our tails at everything is busy. We never have enough time. Time is a big enemy sometimes. So we cut corners in, you know, maybe buying vouchers instead of actually going out to buy a gift, or instead of cooking from fresh. I don't want to come home after 2.5 hours in the car home from London to cook everything from fresh. So you buy a ready-made meal. So we cut those sort of corners. And then you get other corners, you know, that are a bit more dangerous, like this survey, which has been carried out by Gas Safe Register. 9% of people don't wear seatbelts, which is bad. 15% of cyclists don't wear their helmet. That's bad. But then we get to the really serious bit, and that is the thrust of this whole interview and campaign. Don't cut corners, because you can never compromise on safety within your own home when you put your own family and their lives at stake. So that's the serious end of it. So we accept some cutting of corners, but not those.
And that's some of the things that we found from the research was, you know, yes, absolutely, as Gloria said, some relatively low-impact, benign things that you would do. But some of the research showed us that 5% of people would try and service their gas boiler themselves rather than getting a qualified person in to do so.
And that's very bad.
And that's very bad. we wouldn't encourage that at all. And 25% of people don't have a working carbon monoxide alarm in their house, and that's a really good second line of defence. So what this is about today is have an open and honest conversation about the corners that we do cut, the corners that maybe there's not that much impact if you cut them, but saying not all corners are created equal, and some really shouldn't be cut. And the ones around gas safety are certainly something that we would really encourage people not to cut that corner and to know what to do to protect themselves and their family.
Yes, and we've heard so many bad stories and sad stories about carbon monoxide deaths. And Scott mentioned there, you know, the little device you can get to actually put your alarm in your boiler. I mean, do you have one, in fact?
I do. I do indeed.
Good man. you get 10 out of 10 for that. Because a lot of people think that they're very expensive, and they're not, because you can go to any of those big stores and you can buy them for £25-30 or something. And they really can save lives. It's a very good warning. But there's a family in Sevenoaks where I live, and they have been my plumbers, the services for all sorts of things. And I rang up recently about my hob, which is gas, and there was something wrong with that. And he said, no, I can't deal with that because my son is properly qualified, but I'm not for that. So that's another point. Make sure that anybody who comes into your house to do anything with servicing the boiler or anything else, make sure that they're legally qualified. And I'm sure you've got lots of experience there, Scott.
Absolutely.
People aren't.
I mean, there are about 130,000 registered engineers across the country. So there are lots of people out there who are qualified. So you find an engineer through the website, you check to see that they're qualified to do the kind of work that you want done. When they come out, here's a very non-British thing to do. Ask to see their ID card. We're not very good at asking people to do that. I mean, we get very embarrassed and very British about it.
It's just a cut in there and rip off Britain. We're always saying things like that. You know, ask to see their identity. You don't be shy about doing that. Don't get anybody over your doorstep, whether you're talking about electric or gas or whatever, without seeing that card. And, you know, it's like really, really, really important. But as Scott says, we're not very good in Britain about asking things up front like that. And we also say on Rip Off Britain, always read the terms and conditions. That's another thing. No matter what you're doing or buying, whatever appliance it is, you know, actually, just for your interest, you may like to hear this, that one set of terms and conditions had 50,000 words in it. So, you know, we're all guilty of sort of like skimming over a bit of that. So we're trying to say here, obviously, that some of the corners we cut in life, because we are busy, we don't have enough time, are okay. But when it comes to the safety of your family and having your boiler in particular serviced at least once a year and having all those appliances looked at, it's really, really, it makes common sense, and it's our main message today.
Well, thanks for that. And how important is it for the elderly to take this message apart from families?
Well, really important, because we, again, on our program, we have some very sad facts and figures sometimes, because occasionally you'll find elderly people, you know, some don't have that much money. They're very frugal in terms of what they buy in food, and they're very frugal about some of those old electric fires and some of the gas fires that they've had maybe for years and years. And they think that getting somebody in to do the boiler or look at their appliances is going to be really expensive. So there's a bit of vulnerability there, and I'm sure you see that, Scott, many times in your stats.
We really do, and there can be a bit of a false economy. I think sometimes people think, well, you know, I'll use the local handyman, I'll save a few quid here and there. Well, apart from the fact that it might be unsafe, and we know that unqualified gas work is much, much more likely to be unsafe gas work, often you find that someone who isn't qualified won't do as good a job, and you might end up then actually having to pay more in the long run to get things put right. So we would always say, go to the qualified engineer. You know, get this done properly. It's not a compromise. It's not anything around here. It's just something that you need to do properly, and the benefits are not just financial, but, you know, they're about safety.
It's a very good point, though, that you've raised about the elderly. Is there any extra help, you know, for, say, an elderly person living alone that you could give or somebody else can give?
A lot of the energy companies have arrangements in place for vulnerable customers. Now, that might be help with financial aid items around here. Sometimes they can do some of those things. But also it's about what happens should the power go off. So during a power cut, obviously, if the gas work is being done, if they're digging up the street outside the house and they've dug up the road and the gas is off for a while, you know, an older person might be a little bit more vulnerable to cold and other things. So you contact the local gas networks around here, and if they know that there's a vulnerable person, it might be someone with young children in the house, it might be someone with medical needs, it might be an older person, they can put other arrangements in place to make sure you have other heaters, to make sure that you're the first that are switched back on. So it's worth having a look at that. All of your energy providers have duties to do things for vulnerable customers.
The other point is, Chris, that you might be interested in as well. You would be horrified to know that I have grandchildren who are now working and living in rented houses. So I'm in a different phase now. So I'm wondering about rentals. You know, whose responsibility is it? Is it the tenant or is it the landlord? So I know that Scott has this answer.
Well, that's it. So if you're a landlord and you have gas appliances in your house, you have a legal duty to ensure that those appliances are safety checked every year and that you provide evidence that that's been done. It's a thing called a landlord gas safety record. So if you're a tenant, you have a legal right to ask. You can just say, I need to see that, you know, providing me with a gas cooker or a gas boiler or something in here, I want to see that the record that this has been safety checked, has been looked at by a suitably qualified gas safety registered engineer. So that's a really good protection that people should be aware that they have and not be afraid to ask.
And a final word from you both?
Well, my final word is just never compromise on safety within your own home and concerning your own family. I mean, very quickly, although I've been talking about boilers, but I have three gas fires in my house. And one of them in my sitting room, just really last year, this was a real wake-up call for me, because it's a cosy room, but we noticed my husband and I used to laugh and say, every time we go into that room, we fall asleep. And actually, one night I noticed that the flame, and I had done an interview about carbon monoxide before, and I noticed that the flame was really very yellow and sort of it was almost like a rainbow colours. And I thought, that's not right. And I sort of thought I smelled wood, and I thought, that's not right either. So to cut a long story short, it ended up that our chimney was virtually packed from top to bottom with twigs that the birds had dropped in, because there was no cap on the top. There is one now. And the chimney sweeper eventually came along to clear the chimney. He categorically said that had we left that any longer, that we could have been the victims of carbon monoxide. So I might not have been here today at all to talk about it.
From our side, if people are looking for more information, if they're looking to find a gas engineer in their area, check that an engineer they've found is qualified, or get some gas safety advice, have a look at our website, gassaferegister.co.uk, or give us a call on the numbers 0800 408 5500.
And repeat those numbers again, Scott.
So the website is gassaferegister.co.uk, and the contact centre phone number 0800 408 5500.
Now, from gas safe to boating, and just recently, it was the announcement of the Young Sailor of the Year and the Yachtsman of the Year. Presenting the awards, Sailor Extraordinary, Sir Robin Knox-Johnson. And I first asked him how important these awards were to the world of sailing.
I think they're terribly important. And I think what's significant this year is it's an all-ladies final. That's never happened before. And it's not because they're ladies, it's because this year they are the ones who have achieved what deserves these awards. So I think it's absolutely brilliant. It just shows how far we've advanced ladies in our sport.
And how important is sailing, and boating in particular, to young people?
If you take a youngster aged 8 and give them a fender and say, we're coming alongside, and I want you to hold that very carefully so we don't damage the boat, you watch their little face, it's so serious. You're teaching them responsibility. And then they've got the pride in it. And then you let them do something else on the boat. And all the time you're developing, A, their confidence, and B, their feeling of responsibility. We're getting them out there to become good citizens of this country, not a drain on society.
Is there a way that we can encourage more young people into boating?
Well, if we can get the media to at last accept that yachting is not daddy's effing yacht, with gin and tonics all the time, and realise, actually, this is about getting people out into a really fabulous sport. Yes, but until the general media gets around and realises that message, go out and see what yachting's really. Go to some of the sailing clubs. Don't go to all the royal clubs. Go to some of the sailing clubs and see what's really going on in our sport, because that's where the strength of sailing is in this country.
Sir Robin, thank you very much. And the Young Sailor of the Year, Emily, did you expect this?
No, I didn't even know I was nominated, to be honest. So it was such a surprise, but I'm so honoured to win it. And I just want to say that I love competing against the boys as well, but it's so great to show that the girls can win too. So, yeah, it's just so great to share this.
Right. And what's it like being with these other ladies and Sir Robin?
Really inspirational. I never really thought I'd go this far in sailing, but now obviously I'm inspired to go and maybe do the Clifford race and just carry on sailing for the rest of my life.
So you'll be fighting Nikki for the next film. Right, and talking of Nikki Henderson, and you're actually sailing Tracy Edwards, the other winner of the Yachtsman of the Year award, who's won it before. This is your first time. How did you get to sail her boat?
She called me up, actually. To have a call from Tracy Edwards saying, would you sail this boat that I read a book about 10 years ago, it's a bit surreal. But yeah, no, I just returned from taking Maiden to Sri Lanka on her maiden voyage of 2018. So here I am. Yeah, it's a complete honour, and also did not know I was nominated, so great to hear. And also good to see someone like Emily. We actually went to the same school, so that's a bit weird.
So you'll both be appearing on the podium with the trophy.
yeah, it's sort of symbolic to see someone younger than me coming up as well, when I always feel like I'm the youngest, so nice to see the next generation taking it up as well.
And a final word with Tracy Edwards, MBE. Tracy, we've spoken earlier on this programme about the restoration of Maiden. We've just heard from Nikki that she's out in Sri Lanka. Is this all part of the Maiden project?
Well, it is. And, first of all, I'd like to pay a tribute to Sir Robin for creating the Clipper, because the Clipper creates skippers and crew like Nikki and five other female skippers. Of course, they're mixed crews as well, as Nikki, has just said. And I think the Clipper race is actually now more interesting for me than the Volvo, because it's about real racing, it's about real people, it's about people getting out there, all sorts of people, and that's what sailing should be. And again, what Sir Robin was saying about, getting people out on the water. But to have Nikki skippering Maiden has been just like a dream come true. And I never thought she would say yes. I thought, no, I'm far too busy. I have lots of things to do now. So Wendy Tuck has just taken over from Nikki. But what we're doing with Maiden ties into everything that we've been saying here, to encourage young sailors like Emily, to hopefully give Nikki the next bit of her journey, which we know will be amazing. Can't wait to see what that is. So it's just part of the process, and winning this with Nikki has been just brilliant.
And of course this week is National Women's Day, and you've got three lady winners, so... Is that a foretell for the future?
Well, this week has just been extraordinary, because tomorrow we've got the Maiden film coming out, and then on Friday it's International Women's Day, and we've got Nikki back, and so this week has just been amazing. And really, this whole year has been very powerful for women, I think. Women coming together, women supporting women, women empowering women, women standing alongside each other, and then three women winning this, it's brilliant.
Thank you all very much. Now, as they say, it's time for something completely different, as we're joined on the telephone by a young lady called Debbie Bridge, who'll be performing as Shirley the Middle-Aged Siren at the Grand Central Pub in Surrey Street, Brighton, on Tuesday the 26th of March. And Debbie, or should that be Shirley, is talking now to our own Sarah L. Grew.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, I wanted to ask you about the name of your show, because I just love it. It sounds very funny. So can you tell me what your inspiration was behind Shirley the Middle-Aged Siren?
I sometimes have these crazy moments, I think mainly in the bathtub, dare I say, because I don't tend to stop for very long. And it came to me, I was like, what happens to mermaids? Because whenever you think of a mermaid, you're always thinking, oh, young, beautiful, flowing locks of hair. And I'm like, what happens to them when they get older? You never see the older version of a mermaid other than, maybe Poseidon or whatever of the merman type. But you don't see the ladies very much. I've never seen an older one. So that's where she came from, basically, that idea of, well, I'm sure they still exist. And also the fact that being a woman who's now in her middle, I call it my middledom years, you know, how society reacts differently to it. So it's kind of a crossover between what happens to mermaids and what happens to women after you reach a certain age sometimes. You know, if you're a woman of a certain age, you kind of get put on the shelf, or you're not really considered as attractive as when you might have been when you were 20s and all that kind of crazy stuff.
So is that what the show is exploring then?
We do talk a bit about that, you know, what happens to your body. You know, we get things like Shirley talks about getting extra blubber and sea fog and the things that can naturally happen to your body. And definitely when the songs are coming up and everything, she'll say a bit about, you know, what it's like with people trying to put her on the shelf and put her to the side. You know, she talks about it as being put out to sea. So she's like, no, that's why she's on the seashore here in Brighton. She's come over here because they're trying to get her out of, because she's from New York, basically. So she's come over here to sort of go, no, there's a valid existence for her, and she has a right to talk about her story. And she has a thing where she's got a little box of what she's called her pearls of wisdom, and in there she'll pull out a few things to talk about some of her experiences in life and silly stories that have happened over the years.
So I read that there's an operatic twist to the show. Do you have a background in opera?
Yes, I have a degree in opera. I toured with a variety of different small to medium-sized opera companies here in the UK. Worked with the Doyley Cart when they were still in existence, which they no longer perform anymore, which is, you know, opera crossover. It's like a operetta type style of music. Gilbert and Sullivan, basically, but professionally based in the West End at one point. My background is quite broad, but that's where I got to with my singing training. I started out as a music theater jazz background, growing up with country and folk music. So I had a whole lot of influences, and I still, this is why the cabaret isn't just opera. You get a whole range of styles and approaches. But of course, I can't not put the opera in, because one, often I find audiences love to hear it. And two, part of what I'm all about is I don't feel like opera is an elitist art form. It really is something that anybody can enjoy and laugh at and have fun with and just love being, you know, listening to it.
So is there any particular age group that your show is aimed at?
I have a feeling it's going to be for that middle age group to older people, because they'll relate to the issues that she talks about. But, you know, I've been doing it to younger audiences, you know, because I've been guesting her up in London in different people's shows, and she makes everybody laugh anyway. So she isn't limited to that. I just would think that, you know, if you're in that age range and, you know, you might appreciate a bit more what she talks about and in a sense of empathizing with it, but it's not that it kind of cuts out any particular age group, because I haven't found that. Because when I first did her in front of the crowd of 20-year-olds, I was terrified. I thought, oh, they're not going to be interested in what I have to say. But that hasn't been the case at all. They've been really with me and laughed and loved it and really enjoyed the quite broad range of stuff we talk about and the styles of music that, you know, I sing.
I also saw that the proceeds are going towards something called the March of the Mermaids. Could you tell me a bit more about what that is?
The March of the Mermaids happened in 2017 in July, and I'm assuming they're doing it around the same time this year. But they raise money in particular for the charities Surfers Against Sewage, Marine Conservation Society, and the Sea Shepherd UK. Now, normally they just raise it for the Surfers Against Sewage, but this year they've decided to raise money for three charities. And the reason that my show is pairing up with them is because I just love the whole idea of, you know, the mermaid thing works really great. I've watched the parade in over the years and sort of been like, oh, that looks like so much fun, and heard about it. So it's a really good pairing with my show. It's a good pairing with me, because I'm really against the plastic that we use in today's society, in particular what gets into the oceans. So I thought, I like to work with charities when I'm doing my events to not just raise money for my own performances, but also for things that are really important to me. So that's kind of why we got together. And that's why we're raising funds for them as well. and awareness around the whole issue around how we're polluting our oceans and seaways.
Perfect. Exactly. Thank you very much, Debbie, for your time. And hopefully some of our listeners might come and join you.
Yeah, that would be great. We'd love to have them.
Sarah L. Grove was talking there to Debbie Bridge about her show at the Grand Central Pub, Brighton, on Tuesday, the 26th of March. Now it's time to hear all about the latest stage of the restoration of the much-loved Brighton Bell train. And joining us now to tell us all the latest news is Trustee Gordon Rushton.
Well, lots happened. We are going to put out on the rails four cars to start off with, bearing in mind we've got another two later on. If we can get the four cars up and running successfully, people happy with the product, then we'll and being able to make, because we're a charity, so we if we're able to let it, as it were, wash its face and make some money, that money will go into the next two cars to make it up to the full six cars.
It hasn't been an easy job, has it?
Well, the difficulty hasn't actually been in the physical matters, and we've been had some very generous sponsors. The difficulty is in able to meet the really stringent requirements for running on today's railway network with the safety considerations and all the technical upgrades that we've had to make sure that this thing is safe to run, shall we say, on the southwestern main line out of Waterloo, or on the Brighton line out of Victoria, or the southeastern line out of London Bridge. So it's really getting that all right that has taken the time and the trouble.
Are you getting there?
Yeah, we're getting there. Interior refit was rather more expensive than we thought it would, but then we've been willing to put the money up for the simple reason that, or our sponsors have been willing to put the money up, simply because the idea of making sure that you get a really good Art Deco restoration, because this train is unique, has driven us on to go beyond what would be normally realized, required of us. So the need to make sure that we're up to scratch and make a really good restoration has driven us on to make sure that the marquetry is immaculate, to make sure that we re-plated the silver nickel umbrella and hat stands above the seats, and made everything just so as it was in the 1930s when this train was put on the London to Brighton run.
Now, of course, there's modern requirements such as toilets can't discharge onto the tracks anymore.
Well, that comes in 2020, and we thought we'd jump the gun and do it anyway.
Right.
Because, I mean, I think everybody feels that it's in the 21st century, it really isn't quite the thing to discharge sewage onto the track and the underneath of the train. So we've attended to that, and we've got retention toilets all down the train.
The catering, the old kitchens were a little rudimentary, shall we say, a bit basic.
Well, as far as the kitchens are concerned, the old Brighton Bell only ran between London and Brighton 55 minutes. And so if we're going to do long-day excursion service, we needed to do something much more impressive if we want to serve good quality meals onto this train. So we put in a car 85 Grave Time Manor. We put in a 19-foot kitchen capable, when marshalled next to the first-class car Doris, gave you a kitchen centre capable of serving 100, or when we add the other two cars, 170 covers.
So first-class catering, first-class travel. Now, you did have some third-class cars, so have you rearranged the seating to first-class standards?
We found that the seating in the third-class cars, and it was there were three third-class and two first-class in the old Brighton Bell. So the four-car set will be three third-class and one first-class to start with. And so we needed to do something because people in the meantime had expanded since the 1930s. So, and we had the seating that was two and two across the car with an aisle in the centre. And we decided we needed to change that to two and one with a widened aisle so that you could get steward service to serve the meals. It was very expensive, but very much more comfortable.
It looks, I'm looking at a photograph of one of the cars. I mean, it looks superb. It really does. So a tribute to the craftsman.
Well, thank you very much.
I personally can't wait to see these cars. When do you reckon that you'll be able to start testing?
Well, the train has got to get finished at WH Davis. Its interior fit is coming on beautifully. Most of them are, the chairs are all ready and the marquetry is done and the cars are being fitted out and the lighting's been sorted out. And we reckon that the thing which is, of course, the most difficult is all the upgraded electrical systems. But all being well, we would have thought by the end of this year we will go through the testing phase, and we hope that if everything is going to go okay, we would be able to do some commercial operation in 2020.
And it's too early to say where those runs are going to be, presumably.
Well, no, it's very easy to say where it's going to be because we've had to make the arrangements already, and the testing will be done from using Eastleigh as a base with Arlington Engineering. I guess that we would then be free to put it in service. Whether we run to London or not is another matter, but we can certainly do a bit around the Southampton and Brighton area because the coastline takes you straight to Brighton. And four cars fits in number two platform.
I'm sure I speak for everybody in Brighton who can't wait to have her back. So do you reckon, or when do you reckon, you might see Brighton Bell back in Brighton Station?
Well, it's a question of wishful thinking. I don't want to lead anybody on, but the earliest it could possibly run, I would have thought, would be summer next year.
That was Gordon Rushton with the very latest info on the restoration of the Brighton Bell. And that's nearly it for this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme that is produced by Grey Matters Productions for Brighton's only truly local radio station, Radio Reverb, broadcasting on 97.2 FM, on digital radio, and online at www.radioreverb.com. So, until we meet next time over the airwaves in about 4 weeks or so, there's just time for me to repeat those all-important contact details. For more information on the Gas Save campaign, simply go to www.gassaferegister.com. That's all one word, but remember that there are two S's. Or you can telephone 0800 408 5500. For tickets to see Shirley the Middle-Aged Siren at the Grand Central Pub, just go along on the night or telephone Eventbrite on 57022-961212. But now there's just time for me, Chris English, to thank you for listening to this edition of At Home This Morning, which is, as I've said already, a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb. And to again thank my executive producer, Richard Davis, and colleague Sarah L. Grew for all the technical operation matters and, of course, her interview with Debbie Bridge. If you go to www.greymattersproductions.org.uk, you can listen again to a selection of our most recent programmes. And so, until we meet next time, please make sure you keep safe and warm. Bye for now.
At Home This Morning is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.